Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.
Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, fam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome in. PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Pelizzolo, Sam Monson. On a mid-May Monday, Sam, let's talk some football.
Let's do it, Steve. Podcast.
We'll talk some all sorts of stuff. We're going to do most improved defenses. Mm-hmm. Around the NFL. Solomon Wilcox, our very own. He went into some detail over at PFF.com. Most improved defenses around the NFL. What else did you want to chat about? A little Last Dance discussion?
Yeah, I'll talk some Last Dance. Also talk about our hybrids on offense theory. You know, I think it might have been last week before, that we theorized that this idea of receivers into the backfield is a potential edge. Well, I wrote an article on it, did some research on it, you know, into the PFF database. So we actually have some, you know, knowledge now as opposed to just wild speculation.
I like it. Yeah, we'll talk some Last Dance and what that would look like as well from an NFL standpoint. And maybe I'll give my food poisoning story, since that was, you know, The thing that came out was that Jordan was poisoned by food
right. In
the flu game. That seems to be the thing. Which reminds me of the 2007 Nashua Pride and our food poisoning issue. So, yeah, maybe we'll get into that later on. But let's start with the most improved defenses in the NFL. Again, Solly wrote this article, and before I even read it, I was in my head. I was thinking about some of the teams that could have come up, and it made sense. He led off with the Miami Dolphins, and I think obviously when you look at what they added in their secondary, that immediately should make a major impact in Miami.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the Dolphins, you know, they I think outperformed what people thought they would achieve last season. You know, this was a team that was supposedly tanking for Tua, when we thought that involved getting the number one overall pick. You know, not the fifth overall pick. But they actually won some games. They weren't, you know, they took themselves out of the number one pick contention. They won some games. They look like they have a good coaching staff in situ there. And now you get to the whole offseason was about building the rest of the team around him. And they start, I think, pretty heavily with some defense. Byron Jones, we love that as a move. You know, you sign one of the most important positions in the NFL in free agency. You team him with a player you've already invested big money in terms of Xavier Howard. And you can go to town in the secondary. And then they double down on that in the draft with one of their first round picks and go cornerback again. So now you've got three legitimate players that can, in theory, all three play man coverage to a pretty high level. That's what they want to run.
You trying to avoid saying Noah Igbinoghene's name?
No, I can say Igbinoghene.
Oh, okay. Just making sure. You just said a corner, and I didn't know if you were trying to avoid his name.
No.
Yeah, we talked about this on our draft recap podcast. I love the specific players that they added to this defense, mostly in the draft is what we were discussing, but they also add, of course, Kyle Van Noy and Alandon Roberts, you know, former Patriots who know the system and have specific roles to play within that system. They add Shaq Lawson, who's a good run defending edge defender, Emmanuel Ogba, good rotational edge. They have a whole bunch of guys who can fill very specific roles. Raekwon Davis, one of the best interior run defenders. Very specific roles being filled within this defense. And to your point about the corners, Igbinoghene, I think, has outstanding slot corner skills. So pairing that with Xavien Howard and with Byron Jones, they play more as much man coverage as any team in the league, plus safety Brandon Davis, who could play the Patrick Chung role. Like, you could see this Patriot style of defense evolving, and you can see all of the guys that they're adding, how they fit into the overall structure of the D.
And you snag a guy like Curtis Weaver low down in the draft, who, you know, is a player that has outstanding college production, just doesn't have the NFL body type that these guys want to see. But, you know, in theory, there's a much better player in there than his draft position. So, you know, I think a lot of looking at these Belichick coaching tree places is projecting, you know, New England's history essentially onto these teams, whether it's Detroit, whether it's Miami. But if you do that and you say, well, look, the Patriots have had this history of putting guys like that in a position to succeed rather than in a position to fail, you know, asking them to do the things they're not good at, exploiting their weaknesses. You know, if the Patriots had landed a Curtis Weaver, we would be saying this is a phenomenal landing spot for him. He won't be expected to do things he is not good at. He'll be helped become the player that he was in college, even though his body type is less than ideal. You know, if you project that to Miami, who have done obviously a really small sample size so far, but have already shown like flashes of putting players in a decent position to succeed. And, you know, this is at least a you can see the imitation of New England so like presenting itself. Again, in theory, it's a nice landing spot for him.
So the most important reason why the Dolphins land on this list as one of the most improved defenses is because of where they ranked last year in absolutely everything. I love that Solly puts last year's rankings on there for the Dolphins. And you want to know where they ranked 32nd out of 32 in overall PFF team defense grade, 32nd in pass rush grade, 32nd in coverage grade, 32nd in total pressures, 32nd in pressure rate, 32nd in yards per attempt, and 32nd in EPA allowed per play. So the Dolphins were dead last in almost every significant defensive category. So yes, I would say they're going to be one of the most improved defenses almost by default this season, right?
Yes. Has to be. Yeah, you're right, because they basically can't not be. Any form of improvement catapults them up that list.
All right, sticking in the theme of New England, you know, being duplicated elsewhere, the Detroit Lions also make the list. Matt Patricia heads into year three. It's a pivotal year for him. I think, you know, this is really make or break for him, right? I mean, two subpar seasons in Detroit. Matthew Stafford injury last year didn't help. But if they don't win 9 or 10 games, I'm assuming this could be the end for Patricia. But he did the same thing, right? All the New England free agents either went to Detroit or Miami this offseason. So they traded for Daron Harmon. They added Jamie Collins, Danny Shelton, as far as former Patriots go, but also in the draft, adding Jeffrey Okuda, adding Julian Aquara, two guys that we absolutely loved. John Penasini, there's your run-stopping interior D lineman. Even losing Darius Slay, we're still looking at the Lions as potentially one of the most improved teams, because the way Slay played last year was not great, and, you know, they should be much better, I think, on the back end.
Yeah, this one's more interesting because there are two teams effectively trying to replicate what the Patriots are doing. One of them appears to have a coherent strategy of targeting the right areas and then adding pieces where they fit. The other one looks a lot more just like a bad impersonation of what the Patriots are trying to do. And that's kind of the feel I get from the Lions, is that it's like, well, all right, what does the Patriots defense typically look like? Now let's just try and copy it. You know, it's almost like a, you know, it's like a bad Chinese knockoff of a, you know, Gucci handbag. It's like you've seen it. It's more, it's close. Like if from a distance, they look pretty similar, but the closer you get, the more you realize that the stitching, you know, and whatever else defines a Gucci handbag is not the same.
Why do you see a difference between what Detroit and Miami is doing?
Well, so Miami invested heavily in proven, well, one proven cornerback from outside the building, previously one proven cornerback from inside the building, and then a high draft pick who not only, who isn't just sort of contingency for that position, but actually fits alongside those as a slot guy. The Lions decide that Darius Slay doesn't fit this defensive scheme. Okay. They trade him away and replace him with a combination of Desmond Trufant, Jeffrey Okuda, and Darrell Roberts. Now, I like all three of those players in isolation, but like, I mean, I'm not sure that trio is having the same impact that the trio in Miami is having, because your deal.
There's some boomer bust to this cornerback group. I mean, there was a point where Desmond Trufant looked like one of the best young corners in the NFL.
Yeah.
Now, that was about 4 years ago. But as a, you know, rejuvenation project for a lot of money, by the way, well worth it. I think Okuda, we'll see how quickly he hits the ground running as the number three overall pick. And Justin Coleman, challenging role, playing man in the slot, but one of the better guys in the league at doing it. I think as far as a three deep goes at corner, it could be good. I'll definitely hedge and say it could be bad. So it's going to, honestly, I think it's going to really depend on those guys. But on paper, those guys have a shot.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it's necessarily the wrong way of doing it, right? But anytime you see just a huge number of additions at exactly the same position, it speaks to me, it raises red flags of not really knowing what you're doing, right? Or not really having confidence in what you're doing. Like it's that makes sense, I think, for certain positions, like the Dolphins did, right? You add in multiple cornerbacks, you already have one guy in the building, and then you start sort of cherry picking certain positions to add in players. Whereas the Lions, it's like we had a whole bunch of cornerbacks, we had a whole bunch of safeties, we had a whole bunch of defensive interior players, most of whom are the same style of guy, i.e. run stuff or first. Like it just, I don't know that. Like, what is the strategy other than just let's throw a lot at the wall and see what sticks?
I don't know. I disagree because I like that as a strategy, first of all, because even adding Desmond Trufant, you still have Amani Oruwariye there. You mentioned Darrell Roberts. Like, yeah, you want to roll five deep at cornerback. That is a good thing, right? I think that's what they're going to be doing. I think Jayron Kearse, who they add in from Minnesota, has that tight end covering potential as a big safety. Tracy Walker is a pretty athletic safety, and he can be deployed a little bit closer to the line of scrimmage now with Daron Harmon, more of your true free safety. This reminds me a little bit of the Jet, not really the Jets offensive line, but there's like a whole bunch of what ifs of if all these additions hit, this looks pretty good. The Lions have a better chance at that just because a lot of these guys have played well before. We've seen good play from Tracy Walker and Daron Harmon and Desmond Trufant. I mean, this secondary could be really, really good. They're not without question marks, but I like that as a strategy. And adding Jamie Collins and maybe his clone, the next Jamie Collins, Julian Okwara, to your pass rush to go with Trey Flowers, I think is a good move as well. So there's a lot that I actually like about the Lions. I think it's more there's still question marks at linebacker. There's still question marks at, you know, pass rusher getting after the quarterback, even with Okwara added there. So I think they're making moves in the right direction. I'm just not sure if it's enough for this year for Patricia to salvage things.
It's not that division. It's not that I dislike it as a strategy. It's when you see it happen everywhere that they're adding players, it seems questionable. Like if that was their strategy, so the Jets, right? Even though I don't love that because you had to, so the Jets effectively had to upgrade all five starters on the offensive line, right? Which already puts you into a tough position. At the point where you need to find five upgrades on the O-line, to me, you have to start attacking a couple of certainties, because the offensive line, as we talked about before, like the biggest thing is elevate the level of your weakest link. So in order to elevate the level of your weakest link, you should be guaranteeing a couple of spots rather than essentially rolling the dice at all five positions, so that like no matter, like if you roll the dice at all five positions, there's almost no way that the fourth or the fifth guy is not still bad. Whereas if you actually start ticking off some of these spots and say, all right, this guy is only average, but we know he's average. Like, we're going to lock down this spot and then we'll move on and then we'll start rolling the dice with the other ones. You've at least got a decent chance. Whereas the Lions, it's like, well, if you're just throwing darts everywhere, like, what are you doing? Like, I don't see coherence in this strategy. I just see addition and volume.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think it's too bad. Agree to disagree on the Lions. I don't know if they'll be great, but there's potential there. I don't hate the majority of their moves. Let's go to some of the other teams that Solly mentioned here. Las Vegas Raiders. See, I think what you're saying about the Lions fits more with what the Raiders did. They threw volume at a defense that probably needed volume. Again, I don't hate it as a strategy, though. They had to add a lot to the linebacking core, and they did with our friend Nick Kwiatkowski and Corey Littleton there, two guys who are very complimentary. They've thrown some pieces at the defensive line. Malik Collins comes in. But most importantly, they're throwing a lot at the secondary. Now, this is the one where I don't know how much impact that is they've brought in, but from Damon Arnette in the first round. I love Amik Robertson. If he steps in as the slot corner, Tanner Muse at safety, Jeff Heath at safety. So they've added a lot to this back seven. Will it be enough for the Raiders to kind of turn things around from a coverage standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of boils down to how good some of the additions are. But this, I think, has more strategy about it than the Lions, right? It isn't just addition. Like, the idea of adding Kwiatkowski and Corey Littleton, as you say, those are two very complementary linebackers. They function together in a defense that was desperately in need of that position. So you look at the additions they've made, and you can immediately see where exactly they're supposed to fit into this defense individually. And then you can also identify the sort of starter versus depth players from what they've added. It just looks like a more coherent strategy to me. This one essentially comes down almost entirely to, it's tough because this seems to be a recurring strategy with the Raiders, but it comes down to whether they evaluated their top draft pick right. You know, the Mike Mayock has basically said he had Damon Arnette is, you know, right up there with the best cornerbacks in this draft class. Now, nobody else did, so he needs to be right about that. Otherwise, this is a bad pick. And it might be a bad pick if he is right about it, because nobody else had him up there and you could have got him lower.
Really, it's the second year in a row that they took a corner a little bit higher. Well, Arnette probably a lot higher than the consensus. And then I would say Trayvon Mullen, the 2019 second rounder, a little bit higher than the consensus, certainly higher than we had either guy. Those are the two guys penciled in as starters. And then you have, either just a guy like Nevin Lawson, who's just a journeyman at this point. Nick Nelson, who showed a little bit of potential in the 2018 draft class. But, there's not a whole lot to get excited about on that cornerback depth chart beyond Damon Arnette and Trayvon Mullen. And even those two, it's dependent on those guys, right? I mean, they brought in Eli Apple. Signed him, the deal, they lost the deal and essentially replaced him with another Ohio State guy in Damon Arnette. That is going to be what determines a lot about this defense. I like the fact that they get, you know, Jonathan Abram back as their, you know, hopefully box safety. I mentioned Amik in the slot. You know, can they find a little bit of that LaMarcus Joyner magic, finding the right role for him? A lot of questions, I think, in that secondary. I like the linebacking core improvements, though. Those are solid. I think the other question is, did they improve enough from a pass rushing standpoint? They added Carl Nassib on the edge as a guy that, again, you know, a solid rotational guy. You know, he's your number three or four edge rusher. So between him, Arden Key, Max Crosby, Cleland Farrell, is that enough? Maurice Hurst on the interior, is that enough to fix this pass rush that's been a major issue over the last 2 years?
Major issue since the departure of one of the best pass rushers in the NFL in Khalil Mack.
Still the right move.
So you say. That's the big question, because there wasn't really anybody on this defense who was generating a significant amount of pressure. They had a ton of guys that actually had like small amounts of pressure for a defense that basically didn't get to the quarterback at all. They had what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 guys that had double digit pressures, which is kind of up there. Like, that's the sort of number that the Eagles would have, you know, with one of the best pass rushers in the NFL. It's just that the number the numbers of the double digits were higher. Right. So like
the Eagles would have four guys over 50 or whatever it was.
Like the Eagles would have seven guys that had double digit pressures as well, but all seven of them would be up in like the 40s. Whereas the Raiders, only Max Crosby topped 40 with 45. And it took him 481 pass rushes to get that many. So like their best pass rushing grade as a group was Maurice Hurst with a 77.8. Hurst would be the interesting guy because, you know, a player that we loved coming out of college, obviously had the heart condition, which dropped him, you know, where did he go? The fourth round by the end of it?
Fifth.
Yeah. Didn't really hit the ground running in the way we thought he might. But when you're sort of comparing, you know, he got a lot of comparisons to Aaron Donald, right, in terms of undersized, pass rushing, defensive tackles. And that probably does a disservice to Hurst because Donald, you know, is clearly an all-time great freak, and expecting anybody to follow that kind of career path is probably stupid. So Hurst is probably showing you more like what that should look like, right? If you're an undersized defensive tackle, it is still an issue, and it might take you a couple of years to sort of get to the level you should be at because you suddenly have to deal with the size and the speed and the disadvantages that weren't disadvantages in college because you were just a better athlete. He's had to deal with that, and he's getting there. It's just taken a while, right? So maybe year three is actually a good year for him in terms of his career path, his arc, his development curve. And then if you can just find some edge rush alongside him, you're actually getting somewhere.
All that said, Maurice Hurst, top pass rushing grade on the team each of the last 2 years among defensive linemen. I know Max Crosby had 11 sacks and Raiders fans love what he did. And we loved what he did at Eastern Michigan coming out. But, you know, go back to we've had this discussion a million times. The sacks are overrated discussion. He was a good pass rusher last year. The sacks don't really tell the story. He wasn't dominant. 45 pressures on 481 attempts. And the Cleveland Farrell question, he only had 26. So Cleveland Farrell and Maurice Hurst essentially rushed the passer the same number of times. Hurst had five more rushes than Farrell, and Hurst had 12 more pressures on the interior than your edge, Cleveland Farrell. I know he kicks inside sometimes, but a concern, right? So all those guys need to get a little bit better. I'm less excited about the Raiders, I think, defensively than they made some moves, but as far as other teams on this list, I'm less excited about them taking a big step forward.
Max Crosby rushed the passer 481 times. Players around that number, Nick Bosa, Joey Bosa, Von Miller, like there's a bunch of players that were in that ballpark plus or minus 10, and those guys are close to doubling the number of total pressures that Max Crosby had. Bosa had 80 compared with Crosby's 45. Von Miller had 77 compared with 45. Joey Bosa had 72, but his pass rushing grade was 90 compared to 67 because he was winning more decisively. You know, this, like, he rushed the passer a lot, gave him a lot of opportunity. And even by those standards, he wasn't like high up in terms of the amount of wins and pressures.
And there were many Raiders fans who wanted to put Max Crosby in the defensive rookie of the year conversation with Nick Bosa because of those pressures. And we said, look, there's two things. I mean, because of those sacks. And we said, nope. The pressure rate isn't even close, and Nick Bosa's run defense is, you know, at a different level as well compared to Crosby. So exciting year one for a fourth round rookie, but definitely, you know, got to build on that here in year two. The team I am a little excited about, though, is the Arizona Cardinals, and it's not, they're on this list as well. And it's not so much just the additions. It's also expecting guys like Byron Murphy maybe to take a step forward from last year. But I think the Isaiah Simmons addition, if nothing else, it gets a guy like Hassan Reddick, who just looked completely lost. A coverage grade of 29 last year, completely lost in a zone heavy scheme. And when you watch Reddick, you know, he was that hybrid pass rusher. Are we going to turn him into an off ball linebacker when he came out as a first round pick a few years ago? He hasn't really panned out. I think he's pretty much, they're trying to get rid of him in Arizona. He can cover running backs. He's got this great play on film where he makes a great, you know, a nice play on Christian McCaffrey, who's lined up wide. Like when he plays man coverage, it's okay, but he looks completely lost in that zone coverage scheme. And so even though Isaiah Simmons' expectations are high, if he just steps in and he's, you know, average, that the word we use a million times, if he's average in the middle, this defense takes a massive step forward just by replacing Reddick with Simmons on passing downs.
Yeah, I mean, Reddick is looking more and more like just a total miss by everybody, you know, in the evaluation stuff. I can understand why his coverage or his run defense grades suck. Like, I can envisage a scenario where he's just not in the right scheme and he's not as versatile as everybody thought he was, and he's effectively just an undersized pass rusher. But last season, his pass rushing grade was terrible as well. Like, at least year two, the pass rushing grade was pretty good. He didn't do that much of it, but it was good at it. Whereas last season, like, he was just bad at everything. Like, his pass rush wasn't even something to hang your hat on and say, okay, he's just being played out of position. If we make him a pure 3-4 edge rusher, he's, you know, he's more productive than this. Last season, he just looked bad across the board. So you're right. Like, going from one project versatile player to another, if that one actually pans out, they're immediately massively better off.
Yeah, Simmons is a completely different style player, though, because you're taking Hassan Reddick was an edge rusher turned linebacker. Isaiah Simmons is a linebacker slash corner slash safety, essentially a coverage player first that you're trying to slot into the defense as a coverage player who, oh, by the way, will also blitz. You know, the theory that I always love is that if you have a guy that's a great pass rusher in college, hey, if you turn him into a linebacker, they should be able to blitz well and take on running backs one-on-one as a blitzer, not as a designated edge. And for Reddick, as you said, it's been very inconsistent with one peak year there. So I do think, you know, if he sticks around for the last year of his first round contract, then they could find a way to use Reddick. But I think Simmons stealing those snaps will help a lot. And then they didn't add a ton, but I think this goes to the biggest story of everything Arizona's doing is how do their first year and second year players develop, and or how do they impact the team? And their second year players on both sides of the ball from that draft class that we love, there's still optimism. The guys like Byron Murphy, second round pick, looked like the best zone corner in the draft in 2019. Really struggled last year, but a full season of him and Patrick Peterson together, they'll need to take a step forward. But I think, you know, Murphy showed enough in college that he has it in him.
Guys like Byron Murphy are a great reason why, if you're like hanging your hat on the addition being your first round rookie cornerback, it's probably not great because,
yeah,
I mean, even if the guy becomes good, very, very often they're not good year one. So the Raiders, right? Damon Arnett is your big addition. It's all down to how well Arnett plays. Like, I think Arnett was a worse player than Byron Murphy coming out, and Byron Murphy struggled hugely in year one. And we don't even know if he's got the ability to turn that around. We like it because of the college history, but like, year one is not encouraging. And yet, so if that's your Okuda, the same thing, right? Okuda is probably a significantly better prospect than Byron Murphy, but the same idea. Like, if that is the reason you're going in saying, all right, this guy is now our number one addition, he's going to transform our secondary, I'd be concerned about that year one.
Right. I mean, there's enough concerns about Murphy in year two. I do think scheme wise, this will be, you know, this is the right place for him to develop. Also add Devondre Campbell, who's your old school kind of Sam linebacker, can cover tight ends a little bit. But I think with Campbell, Jordan Hicks, who's already been there, he was up and down last year from a coverage standpoint, but battling injury for the big chunk of his career. But Hicks, for most of his career, has been a very good coverage player. I think there's a scenario where you're looking at Isaiah Simmons, Devondre Campbell, and Jordan Hicks, maybe more so Simmons and Hicks together, really locking down the middle of the field better than I think Arizona has in the last couple of years. So I think that's where I'm encouraged. You still have Chandler Jones rushing off the edge. We just spoke about him for 20 minutes on the last podcast. A good, not great pass rusher, but coming off his best pass rushing season. They had 10 sack guy Jordan Phillips there, Sam. He's not going to make that big of an impact, but I think it's more about the back seven in Arizona coming together in year two of this system and some development there that is encouraging, plus adding Simmons in the middle.
That's what would your over-under on Jordan Phillips' sack total be next year?
4.
I was going to say 3.5.
Yeah, 3.5 probably. Yeah, he'll have 3 to 5 sacks if he rushes that much. That's what he is. So that's Arizona. The last team on this list, two more teams on this list, Los Angeles Chargers. And yeah, I mean, I think they're a team, their ranks last year weren't great, which was surprising to us because they're the team on paper every single year that looks good. So bounce back year for the Chargers, I would certainly not be surprised, adding certainly with Chris Harris added to the mix as well, they should be good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just really excited to see what that secondary looks like. Chris Harris coming on board, Desmond King pivoting to safety. You know, what that does for that entire group could be really exciting. And, you know, no division needs it more when you're dealing with the Chiefs. And now the Broncos have just added up a whole bunch of receivers in the draft. So, yeah, I'm just excited to see what this Chargers defense looks like on the back end.
They need to get something from Linval Joseph or year two development out of Jerry Tillery, a guy that we liked a lot and had really disappointed from the 2019 draft. Very poor season as a rookie. So it's either Tillery has to do a better job getting after the quarterback, or Linval needs to recapture a little bit of his magic from previous seasons, and it might be too late for Linval. But I think he's a solid addition to a team that had just massive question marks on the defensive interior for a few years, because they need compliments to Melvin Ingram and Joey Bosa. Those guys can get after the quarterback. You mentioned the depth in the secondary. A full year of Derwin James should help. And then I think all that said, even though we didn't love them trading up for Kenneth Murray, a guy who can chase and run, I mean, if you give him a limited role that I think features his athleticism, you know, he could fly around the field and add something because he's surrounded by a whole bunch of other good players. But I think the linebacking core is clearly the weakness of this entire defense, even with the addition of Murray in the first round.
Which, to be fair to them, is the right way of doing it. Like, if you're going to be weak somewhere, I think that's the right spot to be weak in.
There's actually two more. Solly, how many teams did you put on this thing? There's two more teams on the list. Philadelphia Eagles. This was a fascinating one, because if you look at the guys that they added, it's all hybrid guys in the draft. More specifically, the draft players that they added, all guys who have experience walking out and covering the slot. You know, it's like they found our projection system and used it. Davion Taylor, Kayvon Wallace, two guys who are extremely athletic, have that ability. You know, they're hybrids in every sense of the word, in that they can walk out, they could play linebacker. Wallace is a safety corner, is more of a slot corner, but he's a safety by name, explosive blitzer. Casey Tuhill did the same thing at Stanford, kind of walked out, played, you know, walkout linebacker over the slot. But then the free agency / trade additions, just adding Darius Slay for a third and a fifth, adding Javon Hargrave, Jalen Mills going to move to safety, Sam, so you can hide him a little bit.
Will Parks, another Eagles hybrid team guy.
Will Parks, yeah, another guy. I mean, they are the name of the game this offseason for the Eagles was speed on both sides of the ball, but speed on offense and hybrids on defense. They've thrown a lot into this mix, and I like what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think this will be the Darius Slay piece is kind of key here. I'm also really fascinated by how Javon Hargrave fits on that defensive line. Obviously, the Eagles, more than anybody else, we kind of mentioned it with the Raiders, have been all about redundancy and rotation and just volume in terms of defensive line bodies and getting after the quarterback and all those kinds of things. You know, Fletcher Cox, one of the best interior defenders in the NFL, arguably the best power pass rusher in all of football. It would seem like a more natural fit to get a guy that's like, you know, the speed, penetrating, pass rushing, defensive tackle that plays next to him. Instead, they've gone for a sort of pass, a nose tackle that can do some pass rushing. So I'm kind of interested to see how those two function in the same defensive line, or if it doesn't matter and everybody just rotates enough that there's plenty of playing time for both of them, even if they have, you know, a somewhat redundant skill set.
I think the Darius Slay thing, the trickle down of having him, right? He's coming off his worst season, but the previous, you know, five or six seasons were outstanding for Slay, or at least since he's come into the league in 2013. So if he gets back to form, the trickle down of having him as your true number one corner, not that he's going to, you know, he's going to probably play his side. He's not going to track, but knowing that you feel good about one side, and then last year at this time, it was, hey, the Eagles have volume at cornerback. Well, volume's a lot more attractive when you're just trying to fill one spot rather than two. So you have Nickell Roby-Coleman, who's been a really solid slot corner. So if it's Slay and Roby-Coleman, you're feeling pretty good about left corner and slot. And then the other cornerback position is just a mishmash of Avante Maddox, Sidney Jones, Rasul Douglas, and whatever else sticks there. I feel much better about filling that secondary than I do if, you know, taking those same guys and trying to fill two starting corner spots, right?
Yeah, it's not quite the same as what we've talked about before with the Rams, with Jalen Ramsey. And as soon as you, you know, as soon as you have this legit number one that can track receivers, a guy like Troy Hill becomes an actually pretty good cornerback when he has, when he's like a designated number two. I think Maddox could have a very similar jump in performance if the same thing happened. But you're right. I don't think that the Eagles are going to do, they're not going to use Slay the way the Rams use Ramsey in terms of legitimately tracking that number one. He's just going to be a number one in name and, you know, side of the field. So Maddox's job will get a little bit easier, but it's not going to get Troy Hill levels of easier. But I think he's a guy that, you know, a guy like Sidney Jones could become a number one down the road. He could become nothing. He could be anything, right? Whereas Maddox, I think, has a very sort of clear and defined role that he could become a pretty good number two, but he'll never become like a legit number one. He just doesn't have that tool or that tool set in his bag. But a guy like Darius Slay, that's the knock-on effect, right? If they, him being as good as he can be, helps a guy like Maddox potentially emerge into a number two and win that second job.
Maddox is one of those guys, kind of like Pac-Man Jones, who's kind of got like the slot corner body, but he actually plays better on the outside or plays reasonable on the outside. So yeah. He's not at 5'9". He's not like your classic, oh, you got to put him in the slot. He does a fine job on the outside. And then I think, talk about all those hybrids. It is a good mix of the unknowns in Davion Taylor, the veteran like Will Parks, who has played really, really well. And then Kayvon Wallace, again, another one of the unknowns. It's a good mix of like, hey, what are you going to get from all these guys? How are you going to deploy them? I think among all those players, plus Jatavis Brown, kind of a reclamation project guy that was a really good pass rusher in college, kind of that what we were talking about with Hassan Reddick. He was a lot like that, athletic, could move around and do. They've added so many guys that can do multiple things in their back seven. So I can't wait to see how they deploy them. I'm just going to bank on, hey, one or two of those guys work out because they've been good players in the past. I think between that, Darius Slay, Hargrave, at least replenishing some of that pass rush on the interior, even if it's not perfect. I'm looking at this team and thinking this could be the most improved defense, Sam, the Eagles.
Yeah,
I think they're the team.
I could buy that, particularly because I think some of their issues were underachieving within the group already. You know, I think they can be better without adding anybody, just by everybody playing better.
All right, and then rounding it out, Solly talks about the Tampa Bay Bucks. Now, overall, they were very good defensively last year. They just were. They had their ups and downs. I think there's two ways to look at this. They either have this up-and-coming group of corners in Carlton Davis, in Jamel Dean, two monster corners, Sean Murphy Bunting in there, and they've thrown a ton of resources at the secondary. They're either up and coming or it was such a small sample size that we really don't know what we're going to get out of those guys. This could go either way, I think, for the Bucs. And I think the thing that might make them not improve defensively is Brady's at quarterback. You got to face Breeze twice. You have to face Matt Ryan twice. You got to face the Chiefs. They have a tough schedule of offenses that they're going to face. And I think they're going to be in a bunch of shootouts. And I think they're going to be challenged in the back seven for the majority of the year.
Yeah, I mean, this is one I don't know that I would put on the list because it's basically retention of guys he already had and then Antoine Winfield Jr. in the draft. And I like that as an addition. I think Winfield Jr. is potentially a really nice safety for this defense. But the big thing was always leaning on the development of those corners you just talked about because they were on fire down the back end of the season, looking like they were really heading in the right direction. Like Jamel Dean, it was one of the best. I think he led all cornerbacks in pass breakups or something, or all rookie cornerbacks in pass breakups, despite playing like a third of the snaps of some of the other guys. Like he just went on a run the back end of the year where he was getting his hand on all kinds of passes and breaking them up. So if that group takes another step forward or even just maintains the level that they ended the season on, now they're cooking. You add Winfield to that, you're in really good shape. The area of concern would be, you know, they basically bring back that defensive line that was all hinging on, you know, Shaquille Barrett leading the NFL in sacks, and like that will not happen again. It was a anomalous number. You know, and he'll be a good player again because he's been a good player every single season of his career, regardless of role. But this, I mean, his 2019 was an exercise in how sometimes the statistics can just swing your way and the same player can wind up with a NFL sack leading season despite nothing changing. You know, and I just, I mean, it's a franchise tag, right? So it's 1 year. Does they haven't committed massively to it, and it's not overkill. But just this idea of, you know, you don't let a sack leader walk out the door. You can't find those guys. Like, I mean, you can. You can find a Shaquille Barrett pretty regularly. Like, Jadeveon Clowney is still on the open market. Jadeveon Clowney is probably a better pass rusher than Shaquille Barrett. He's at least in the same ballpark. So you can find
Clowney
those guys.
Clowney had 3 sacks last year, Sam, not 20.
Yes.
Come on.
I'm just saying that if you're banking on Shaquille Barrett bringing the same kind of 20-sack presence that he did a season ago, you'll be disappointed.
All right, so that rounds out the most improved defenses. I thought it was a great job by Solly. It's over at PFF.com. And then you wrote today, let's transition now to the matchup nightmare that the NFL should be exploiting. And it's not completely new. We've seen it a lot this decade. And I like the fact that we talked about it last week. You dove into the numbers and researched it. The title of the article is Why Hybrid Receivers Who Could Pose a Rushing Threat Could Be the NFL's Next Big Matchup Weapons. So just to lay the groundwork for what we...
So not the headline I wanted to go with, by the way.
That's pretty long-winded. What was yours going to be?
Mine was going to be running backs don't matter, but do hybrids.
Oh, man. How is that not what we rolled with?
Right? That was the premise, right? That was what we basically talked about last pod or whatever. We talked about that idea. Yeah. And the further theory was mine, which is, look, I don't think that this just motioning a back out of the backfield and lining him up as a receiver really does anything anymore. This idea of you get these matchup weapons like a Le'Veon Bell or a Christian McCaffrey, and they can run receiving routes, and that's what makes them special. My theory was that that doesn't really do anything, and that moving people the other way is what actually screws with the defense. Taking receivers and putting them in the backfield messes with defenses in a way vice versa doesn't happen, right? So my first step was to talk to some of the smart football people that work for PFF, guys that have been in the NFL, guys that have been running college programs, and of course you.
You were asking me all about it.
Well, I asked you on the podcast, then I went to talk to smarter people that have been in the league.
Oh.
So talk to Bruce Gradkowski, talk to Tim Beckman, you know, former college coach, and, you know, basically start running the theory by them, right? What do you guys think of this? And they agree. They were like, yeah, the thing that will stress a defense is taking a receiver, putting him in the backfield, because now you have a personnel problem. And so this article essentially walks through all these different stages. The idea that running backs don't really matter is not a new one, right? Or at least not, it's been done to death, right? Us and everybody else. What's really interesting is, so there's a couple of things. The first, even these players that we think of as matchup problems are not anymore. Christian McCaffrey, Le'Veon Bell, David Johnson, running backs that just move from the backfield out to receiver do not scare defenses the way we think they do, because defenses have figured it out by now. It's been happening for years, and they're no longer... we can all think of like plays where it's made a difference. You know, oh, look, he's been isolated on a linebacker. It's a big play. But that's anecdotal, right? That is highlight reel mentality. That's not the way the world works, because we can all think of a million plays where receivers just make big plays, right? It happens. It's just a big play. So overall, running backs moving out and lining up at receiver have a dramatically worse production rate than receivers lining up at receiver, or even tight ends lining up at receiver. They're just worse at it, right? They're not as good. And even guys like Christian McCaffrey, we think of McCaffrey as like the gold standard of a player who can play receiver and running back. McCaffrey has a better yards per target rate from the backfield than he does lining up at receiver. And he makes explosive plays more often from the backfield than he does lining up at receiver. The bottom line is, we think of this as this giant cheat code of exploitation, and it isn't anymore. Defenses are not scared anymore by you motioning a guy out of the backfield, lining him up at receiver, and targeting them. They know how to deal with that. Now, the reverse is where things get interesting. You take receivers and you put them in the backfield. Now, number one, if those guys carry the ball, their average per rush is actually higher than running backs. So if nothing else, now it's a small sample size, right? So I'm not like leaning on that to say you're better doing that. But if nothing else, it's not like a problem, right? You're not seeing a dramatic suffering in your run game by moving these guys and handing them the ball, which is interesting because not only does it suggest that, hey, running backs don't matter, but apparently that extends to the guy carrying the ball not even being a designated running back. Like, the effects of all the other things generating rushing success is so powerful that the guy carrying the ball does not even need to be a running back in order for him to have that kind of success. So that's like my first interesting takeaway from it.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. And so to lay the groundwork for why we were discussing this too, I think the theory went like, if you defenses match up in the huddle, they don't match the formation, right? So they have people in the box up top who are saying it's 11 personnel, which means there's three wide receivers, a tight end, and a running back out there. So sometimes they see, you know, four wide receivers and a tight end. And okay, that's the personnel group. And once you see that offensive personnel group come out, you match up defensively. It's like, all right, give me all the defensive backs. Give me my six or seven, my dime or my seven defensive back look, right? If one of those receivers can now just go into the backfield, you have at least one or two guys who don't feel comfortable playing the run in the box, right? So that's where the mismatch is being exploited. Anytime you're putting a running back out on the field, they're pretty much matching him with a linebacker. And to your point, the linebackers are either in the box playing the run, or if you do split them out wide, they're more comfortable doing it now than they were, you know, 20 years ago when you had a big sloth, you know, two down linebacker out there. So it all started from the basic theory that you're going to break defenses because you have guys who are uncomfortable playing the run, all of a sudden playing the run.
What it also and then, does. Yeah. So that was definitely the sort of starting point, right? It said in theory, you take this guy, you move him into the backfield, and suddenly you've got a slot corner trying to defend the run on the edge. Right. The other thing that it does that I noticed when I started looking at some of these plays is that there's also this level of confusion pre-snap, right? Even if you're happy with the personnel group you've got on the field, when the offense breaks the huddle and starts to line up and suddenly you've got a receiver in the backfield, there's this couple of seconds where the defense, you know, the linebackers, the guys that are calling the defensive plays and try to get everyone lined up are like, wait, we thought we had X personnel group on the field, but now I've got this guy. Like, where the hell is my, you know, they're trying to find the guy. It's like, where the hell is my tight end or my receiver that we had in the huddle? Where'd he go? And then this crap, he's in the backfield. Uh-oh, what? And, you know, there's these couple of seconds of figuring out what on earth is happening in order to get lined up right, even if you're happy with the way the personnel is on the field. And that, you get these huge plays regularly with, you know, Cordarrelle Patterson, Percy Harvin, Aaron Hernandez, because there's these seconds of confusion where the defense is trying to figure out what's going on.
Go downstairs, Teddy.
Nice. We got trampolining in the background. They can't see that, though.
People can't see it. It's being cut on the show. But yeah, there is
perfect
trampoline activity. Also, I got pretty startled there. We had a mouse incident in the house yesterday. So anytime I see anything out of my periphery, I'm a little jumpy right now. And I saw, yeah, 3-year-old Teddy over here out of my periphery. So I'm jumpy.
You're like, you know, the idea that like elephants are always terrified by mice. That's you.
Nobody likes mice. Nobody wants to see a mouse crawl.
Nobody likes
kitchen,
them,
right?
But like, there's degrees of being freaked out by them, and you would appear to be a higher degree than you would expect for a man of your dimensions.
It was an adrenaline rush. Depositing the mouse, getting rid of it.
How did you get rid of it? Oh, we're gonna get like PETA complaints and stuff. What did you do?
I don't know. Mouse traps are legal, right? I used a trap.
Of course, illegal. That's not going to stop PETA coming out.
I don't know. Well, they're going to come after me for sure. But look,
did you have to protect my food,
my kids?
Yeah. Did you have to like finish it off, or did you just like toss it in the trash?
Now I don't want to answer because I don't know who's listening. But there was a trap. He stuck to the trap.
Yeah.
We got rid of that.
Okay.
You know? 4-year-old Harry, help me. Teddy, go get your cookies. See you, buddy. Love you, man. Thanks, honey. So,
this is good podcast content right here.
We took care of it. Yeah, we'll wait till the food poisoning story comes out.
I think you should tell the story of what you think happened to your hard drive.
Okay, so, well, let me just finish this thought.
Yes.
There are comments.
Right.
There are comments in the YouTube chat that wide receivers don't run through the between the tackles.
Right.
And that is false. The examples we're using are Tyreek Hill and Randall Cobb and Aaron Hernandez and Cordarrelle Patterson. They ran power.
Yes.
They ran inside zone. They ran outside zone. They ran all the same run concepts. We're not talking about trick plays. We're
right.
talking about
Number
literally
one.
Deploying a wide receiver slash tight end in the backfield as the running back.
Number one, I'll be tweeting out a bunch of these plays so you can sort of see what things people have done with these players. Two, yeah, the first thing you do is you're like, well, let's look at the yards per carry. And you're like, well, yards per carry from all receivers is really high, but that includes end arounds, that includes jet motion, it includes all these plays that are like designed to get these guys into space and succeed primarily because you don't run them very often. Like if you ran an end around every snap, people would defend the end around. But the reason it succeeds is because you run once every game or whatever. So it's a surprise. So you're like, okay, well, what happens if you strip all of those out and just confine them to legitimate like running back run concepts, inside zone, outside zone, power, trap, the same crap everybody else is running. And again, their numbers are higher. Now, I think it's a valid thing to say, look, not every receiver can do this, right? Like there are receivers out there that do not want any part of getting hit. And those guys you probably don't want in the backfield taking handoffs. But one of the things Tim Beckman said, who coached this guy, can you imagine like if Dez Bryant had this as a gig? Like Dez Bryant used to get smoke routes out on the perimeter in the red zone and just like dominate the dude in front of him, right? You just fire him the ball. There's a cornerback 2 yards in front of him and Dez Bryant goes, to hell with you. I am going through you into the end zone. Can you imagine Dez Bryant lined up in the backfield, you know, motioning to the backfield, taking handoffs? Like he would be good at that. Julio Jones, those kinds of guys, right? So it's not a product of these guys running weird ass concepts that don't exist for running backs. But the point with the yards per carry thing was just that if nothing else, it's not a bad thing, right? You're not sacrificing something in the run game to move these guys into the backfield and exploit that. What I was more interested in is, does it work overall? So what happens if you pull the pass game back into it and look at yards per play, yards per, you know, overall play on offense? Does moving these guys cause like an uptick everywhere? And when you pull out that overall number, again, all these numbers are like back to 2006, right? Since PFF has been doing data. Basically, no, it doesn't look like it does, right? The number is almost identical. It's like 5.9 something yards, whether it's a receiver in the backfield or whether it's every other play. But again, like the receiver matters, right? Who the guy is, because some of these guys, as opposed to the theory with running backs, is that essentially all of them are good in the NFL, so it doesn't really matter which one you put back there because everything else is the thing that's generating the production. But there is a floor to that, right? Guys, if you don't want to take contact, you're probably going to be a bad running back in the NFL. So at least you need guys that are like willing to do that, right? So let's start looking at the receivers who've actually had something like this role in the past. And if you dial it down to like Hernandez, Patterson, Percy Harvin, Tyreek Hill, you remember Joshua Cribbs. Ty Montgomery, Randall Cobb, it was one or two more maybe. If you dial it back into that list, suddenly the numbers start to spike in your direction. And actually that is having an effect. Those guys...
Is this a viable strategy, or is it, well, those guys are so unique, like we're naming 8, 10, 12 guys through 15 years of data.
Yes. Here was my conclusion, right? Is you're right. Because that was a big part of it. Is the bottom line is you're still dealing with stupid small sample sizes in terms of receivers lining up in the backfield and taking an actual backfield carry. Percy Harvin leads the NFL since we've been doing this, and including the playoffs, he's had 90 of those carries, right? Which is like, that's not a tiny sample size, but it's 90 over a career. And there's no way of knowing what happens if instead of 90 in a career, he has 90 of those in a season, right? What does that do to the numbers? But what I concluded is that, you know, remember when Cameron Wake had an absurd pass rushing productivity, win rate, pressure rate, everything, grade, but he rushed the passer 150 times in the season, right? And it's like, well, we don't know what would happen if you rushed the passer 500 times in the season. He was an every down player. you know, he couldn't possibly be that good, because if he was, he wouldn't have gone undrafted, wouldn't have been bouncing around the CFL. But you have to find out, right? Otherwise, you're just sitting on something that's clearly better than you're missing out on all this potential if you just decide that, well, it doesn't scale, so let's not bother. Like, with Cameron Wake playing that well on that number of snaps, you have to start increasing the snaps to find out if it scales.
The thing is, I don't know if you need this to scale or not. I would still view it as, like, if you're a play caller and you're going to call 70 plays in a game, say, on average, 65, 70 plays. And we always talk about, hey, play action is a cheat code, right? It always moves defenders, just run it a lot. To me, if you just add up all these different ways of stealing yards here and there, so you have X amount of, hey, we know we're going to run a little bit more play action than, say, the average. We know we're going to have this hybrid player, in the backfield for 8 to 10 snaps, right? How many plays can you steal in a given game? I would look at it like that, not so much like, maybe there is like the next wide receiver that becomes like a 20 carry guy and he's going to literally line up all over the formation. You're going to run empty with him out wide. I mean, it's just going to completely break defenses. Maybe, but I also don't know that you need to chase that. I think at least if you have somebody mentioned, same guy is mentioning Laviska Shenault. Like, if I have Laviska Shenault, I could have a nice 8 to 12 plays per game where he's in the backfield. Okay, that's good. Then I have my play action plays. Then I have, quick game. Then I've got my screen game. And before you know it, you're at like 35 plays. You got half your play call sheet where it's like, wow, I got a lot of cheap yards I'm picking up here. And then the other half, it's just, hey, quarterback, right, wide receivers, go make plays. I think as many plays as you can steal, the better.
The very bare minimum. This says that every team that has one of these players that they think is capable of doing this should have this in their playbook, right? Because it's free yardage a lot of the time, and why wouldn't you? The next step is, if you have a Laviska Shenault, if you have a, what's the Memphis dude's name?
Antonio Gibson.
Yeah, Antonio Gibson. If you have one of these style of players that is a legitimate, like a viable wide receiver and a guy you think could be decent taking handoffs in the backfield, you should be figuring out, you should be using that reasonably, a decent amount, right? You should give that guy a few carries a game and see what happens. And then if that's still successful, keep pushing the edge, right? There's no point. Like, the NFL to me is all about, if something is working, keep pushing it until it's not working anymore. Because if nothing else, you'll find out A, where it stops scaling, and B, you might reach a thing where the only way of stopping this is to overcompensate and open something else up. So maybe the way of, like, maybe defenses adjust to this, and the way they adjust to this opens up the deep ball for somebody else, right? Whatever it is. So this should be getting pushed until you see some kind of pushback from you doing that.
This is where football and spreadsheets works, though, right? The people who, you dorks, you can't play football on a spreadsheet. Like, football coaches have been thinking about this for a while. Football coaches spend every single day all week figuring out math. How do I get fewer guys in the box to defend the run? How do I stretch the field horizontally? Which is just a numbers game. How many guys are here? How many guys are out wide, right? So if one of the variables for a successful run game is box count and how many players are in the box to defend the run, as soon as you put a running back out there and you put a fullback in there and you put two tight ends out there, you're immediately bringing everybody into the box to defend the run. And you're immediately, no matter who the running back is, you're decreasing your chances of success, even if you have Adrian Peterson back there. But once you put the wide receiver in the backfield, you're either going to bring a worse run defender into the box, or you might not bring a box defender in at all, because they just don't know how to line up against this. That's another part of this thing, right? Defenses don't line up comfortably against unorthodox sets, say, right? It takes them a split second, or maybe they didn't practice it, or even if they are going to practice it, do you really want a corner lining up as your will linebacker on a given play because of the alignment, right? So you actually might get fewer players in the box rather than, oh, here's your running back, fullback, and three tight ends, and of course, here's 10 in the box, right?
There's another couple of things it can do. One, I think you might see, so if you started to scale this and started to make it a bigger part of an offense, and let's say it took off league-wide, I think you would almost see a pivot in terms of the defensive players the teams start to covet. Guys like Richard Sherman suddenly become a lot more valuable in terms of a cornerback that can set the edge on a run play, because you're still matching up with these guys with defensive backs, but you now need defensive backs that you're not sad if they're actually defending the run on a side of the field. You know, and guys like Richard Sherman are great at that, but nobody cares about that anymore. Like, cornerbacks going high in the draft that can't defend the run to save their lives because they don't need to anymore. That would suddenly become a thing you need to think about again. And the other thing is, there's so many more things you can do with this creative, you know, creative wise that really mess with defenses. Like, I've seen a few. This actually, interestingly, didn't seem to, there were a few plays here and there, but this overall did not have a huge effect. If you motion the player into the backfield as opposed to just lined him up there, you know, so if you took him and lined him up out wide and then put him back in the backfield, that didn't seem to have like a giant spike in numbers. But some of the plays where that's happened have been like devastating, because the Vikings did one where they were actually in a heavy formation. They lined up with a fullback, sort of running back fullback hybrid who was in the backfield. And then they motioned Patterson out from wide to a tailback. Suddenly they're in I formation and they're able to screw with the numbers and basically run a sweep back to the side that that Patterson came from. And suddenly there's lead blockers. You know, they've basically just completely changed the count because they now have a lead blocker in the fullback. They have a puller. It was a power play, so they've got a pulling offensive lineman coming around the edge. Patterson,
that's
like,
a
goes
lot of
off,
movement.
Right. Patterson goes off for like 65 yards and a touchdown. And then there was another one where the Patriots lined up in, it was an 11 personnel group, but the back was a fullback. So it was James Devlin. They catch the pack because it's 11 personnel. They catch the Packers in dime defense. Patterson comes into the backfield and suddenly it's, wow, now they're like I formation in a power look against the dime defense. And they just plow up the middle for a touchdown. Like, you can screw with defenses so many different ways by embracing this as a concept and, you know, causing like no end of trouble.
Yeah, it's awesome, because I think part of the reason why we all love football is because of the X's and O's and the cat and mouse game. It's one of the reasons why I loved working for PFF early on and still do, is because that stuff's intriguing and we get to do that full time for a living. So when you get to dive into it and come up with some of this stuff, I think it's a lot of fun. So did you have any final points on that, or just, hey, go read the article? Because first off, go read the article, pff.com. Mm-hmm. Any final points on the receiver?
Read the article. Back. I will be posting a few GIFs or videos on Twitter to sort of back it up and you know, look at some things as well. Like I said, my main takeaway was, look, this works and has worked over an extended period of time. Anecdotally, it causes defenses a lot of problems, at which point start doing more of it. And let's find the point where it doesn't make sense anymore. And until we do that, we're leaving a lot of meat on the bone, because this has been a successful tactic and teams are not employing it enough.
Here's the other point I really, really want to make too. I think the wildcat, I've mentioned this before, but like the wildcat, and when people are like, oh, everybody's going to have that, and like, let's steal plays. The wildcat was a different offense, right? It changed your offense. I think the advantage to having the wide receiver running back hybrid is you're running the same offense. You have the same quarterback. It's the same set of plays. Mm-hmm. And especially if you get into a no huddle situation and it's like, here's my personnel group. Right. We're locked in for the next 8 to 10 plays. And if you're stuck in a bad defensive personnel group, we're just going to exploit it. If you're ready to stop the run, and we're going to pass. If you're ready to stop the pass, we're going to run. But you don't change your offense. You run the same exact plays, right? When you run the wildcat, you literally take practice reps away from your quarterback, and you're like, hey, running back, go take this direct snap and run power and run these different plays. And it messes with the box count a little bit, but all you have to do is bring an extra guy in the box if the dude can't throw the ball. So I think the wildcat was easier to adjust to, whereas this is like, hey, we're just running the offense and we're just going to make you wrong because of our personnel, because of what our personnel's capable of doing while running our offense.
Yeah, the fact that you don't have to practice it is the big thing. That's you know, one of your big points is anytime you do any of these weird, quirky things on offense, you have to waste time practicing this as much as the defense has to practice to stop it. This, you don't. All you need is a receiver who can learn backfield carries, and maybe you give him a few practice reps at running back during the week. Even if you don't, like Mike Leach, I don't think practices the run game, right? He just, like, it's all, they run when they're given favorable looks. So why bother practicing it, right? This is the same kind of theory. Like, you probably don't need a receiver. If you are confident in this guy's ability to do that, a lot of running is instinct anyway. So you don't need to, as long as he knows where the run is designed to go, you don't need to practice that on a daily basis. So you don't have to burn time getting good at this.
Yeah, my whole, yeah, I don't know if it'll work when I'm GM, but the idea that, hey, we're not going to spend so much time instilling toughness. And, you know, like if you just spent more practice reps on the pass game, though, that's one of those things we don't know what all 32 teams do. There's no way to like get data on that to actually study it. But I wonder if a team, whatever the breakdown is, if most teams go 50-50 run game and pass game, if some teams practice 75% pass game, both sides of the ball too, right? If you truly think that's the most important thing, how that would work, that is very much the Leach style. So really good article. Go check it out, pff.com. Let's wrap it up with discussion about my hard drive, food poisoning, so and the last
dance.
Tell me
what happened to your hard drive. What you think happened to your hard drive? Because you came on and you told me that you thought the hard drive that you have all these old historical games sitting on was gone. And when you said that, like in my mind, I was picturing, you know, hard drive makes weird noises, no longer loads. But no, you meant like it's disappeared.
It's legitimately gone. I think we're in quarantine. I haven't left the house with my hard drive or anything. So it plugs in. It's got all these games, right? From the 2000s, the 90s, the 80s, all this stuff. I've got hundreds of games on there. And I plug it into my desktop, which sits on the right side of my desk right over here. And I look up the other day and all I see is the plug to the hard drive, but no actual hard drive there. Right. So I'm thinking, you know, my kids play up here every now and again, as we saw. It's near the edge of the desk, so maybe I knocked it off or whatever it is. So I'm looking on the floor and the actual hard drive is nowhere to be found. Now, under my desk, right about where it may have fallen, also is where my trash resides. So I think the last time I actually used it was probably late last week, and I took the trash out last Monday. So there was this brief period of time where maybe I had no idea. But when it fell off my desk, I'm going to blame my kids. It was probably them. It fell off my desk into the trash, which I brought out to the trash and got disposed of on Monday. So there's a good chance hundreds, maybe thousands of games are out in a dump somewhere on my hard drive.
That's an amazing way to lose the hard drive. It really is.
I looked everywhere up here. Wait, where else could it have gone?
I just loved how quickly your detective work would put all that together. It's like I look up, all I see is a wire where there should be a hard drive, and the trash can is under that, and I probably fell in, I tossed it away, and it's gone.
Well, that was my first theory, and then I tried to confirm that it wasn't by looking everywhere, and then I was like, first theory was correct. It's in the trash.
Last week, we talked about this idea of the report, right, that the Seahawks that had offered the Browns the number one, or had offered the Browns Russell Wilson for the number one overall pick in the 2018 draft, right? I think we brought that up in the podcast. And there's been added movement to this, which is the idea that if that deal had come off and the Browns had taken Russell Wilson, given them number one overall, the Seahawks would have drafted Josh Allen number one overall. Can you imagine, like, the entire league changes? Josh Allen to Seattle, Russell Wilson to the Browns, Baker Mayfield, who the hell knows, the Jets probably took Baker?
Giants or Jets? Would the Giants have taken Baker at that point?
No.
They had a sleepover.
Yeah.
Pretty sure they had a sleepover before.
It would have been, I think the word was the Jets liked Baker as well. Wasn't there crazy talk that like the Patriots were planning on moving if he hadn't gone number one?
The Patriots were trying to go to number two.
Right.
Yeah. So they were trying. Now the Giants never would have traded two. So that's the thing. There are rumors, or we have inside info, that the Patriots were trying to trade up to number to wherever to get Baker Mayfield.
Right.
But
Giants weren't answering the phone.
There's no chance they would get to two with Gettleman there. There's no chance the Jets would let them do that in the division. So whoever had number four that year, which I can't remember off the top of my head right now,
that relies on the Jets passing on Baker when they had a choice.
Well, then, yeah, the Giants still maybe would have gone Saquon, and then the Jets would have debated Baker.
The Giants,
and Darnold,
I'm almost certain, would have taken Saquon regardless of anybody.
Yeah.
The Jets, I think the talk was that the Jets liked Baker a lot, so I think the Jets might have taken him at three. If this could be insane. Like, if you think of the ripples of this butterfly effect, the Browns are immediately a good team because Russell Wilson is that good. The Patriots could wind up with Baker Mayfield at number four with a blockbuster trade after he slips past two other teams. like that in and of itself is kind of nuts, because suddenly Baker has a year to sit behind, 2 years to sit behind Brady.
Or does he even sit? Do they force him into the lineup in 2018?
Nah.
Do the Patriots even win the Super Bowl that year?
They're not forcing.
They would roll with Brady probably for one more year than it would have been Baker in 2019.
And then Russell or the Seahawks, they get to test this theory of, well, clearly our quarterback is not actually that important a part of our offense. And we've gone from Russell Wilson to Josh Allen. Like, that would have been fascinating, because I mean, Allen has a lot of the skills that Russell Wilson has in terms of plus athleticism, in terms of capable of making some big plays, in terms of they have dialed down. Like, they don't ask him to pass 50 times in a game. So I would have been like, that would have been pretty fascinating to see what Josh Allen would end up in that offense.
There's also this element of, yes, environment matters a ton. We talk about quarterbacks and how important they are, but environment matters a ton, right? Like, Brady probably doesn't become Brady if he doesn't at least land in New England, get certain opportunities, and okay, there's probably there's a point where he becomes, I think, the best of all time and what have you, but it was bred through this environment. Same thing with, say, Drew Brees being with Sean Payton, Patrick Mahomes going to Kansas City. The fact that Seattle was the team that they thought Russell Wilson was a first round player, they just played the draft and got him in the third. Could Seattle have gotten the very best out of Josh Allen? Right? Or are we actually seeing the best out of Josh Allen? Is there still more to come? Like, what would have happened with Pete Carroll? Like, the fact that they bought in so much to him that was even, you know, one of their thought process, would they have fostered an environment where Josh Allen did become a star in Seattle? Not saying that, like, this doesn't take away from Brady or Russell Wilson or Breeze or any of the star quarterbacks, but they still pretty much need some sort of environment to kind of like kick it off, right? To start it. Right. And I wonder, maybe that would have been the case for Josh Allen.
If this did happen, how insane.
Or Seattle would have just been a disaster of a franchise and made the biggest mistake in NFL history. Yeah. Or one of them.
If this did happen, how insane are the Browns for not taking it? Like, at that point, so Wilson's 29 years old. Okay, you got to pay him big money, but he's a 29-year-old proven superstar, and you haven't been able to find a quarterback for 20 years.
So we've done a lot of research on, and we're going to write it this week, I think. Eric Eager is going to rewrite it again this week about paying the quarterback, and it comes down to just how good they are. Now, knowing what we think we knew about Baker Mayfield and having him on 4-plus years of essentially a 5-year first – you have him on a first contract. I think we would sit there and debate it. Right. You have to pay a ton of money to Russell Wilson, a lot of money to Russell Wilson versus Baker Mayfield on a 5-year contract, knowing what we think we knew as far as projecting him going forward. I don't think that's a slam dunk. Let's not have revisionist history here. I heard the forecast guys say, oh, it's slam dunk. Russell Wilson. Wilson's coming off his two very best seasons right now since his rookie season.
True.
In our world, he was grading high 70s, low 80s. Our evaluation of Baker Mayfield probably had him even higher than that from a projection standpoint. Now, there's an unknown with Baker versus the known Wilson, but I think at the time that is not a slam dunk. Hey, you got to take Russell Wilson. Not at all.
Do you think, though, that there is value to the idea of, look, so in abstract terms, there is there's a point at which you pay the quarterback, there's a point at which you don't, and you're better off, you know, shooting for the next guy and blah, 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 right? But Team X in a random scenario sometime in the NFL landscape. This is the Cleveland Browns, who literally have not been able to find a quarterback in 20 plus years of trying. Like, there's got to be value to the idea of, look, this one is this. We know there's no guesswork. We don't have to hope that we didn't screw the eval up again. We know this guy is good. Let's just solve it now.
I think the debate is different if you're not sitting on the number one overall pick, when from our point of view, the best quarterback prospect since Andrew Luck is sitting there, right? So if you are, say, the Buffalo Bills right now, you don't know what Josh Allen is going forward, or you were the Bears, you didn't know what Trubisky was after year two, right? Presumably. You don't know what Sam Darnold is with the Jets. If you're one of those teams and the option is on the table to go get Russell Wilson, I think it's a no-brainer. If you're sitting there with the number one overall pick with a really highly projected quarterback, that you can have on the rookie contract, I think it's at least a debate. Now, on the other hand, I think that it's less so I'm the Browns. It's more so our theory of you find a top eight guy, you lock him up, and you just build around him. Wilson is a top eight guy. As much as I'm saying, oh, you don't know what he is. He hadn't been a top three guy, but he's a top eight guy, right? So you lock him up and you go. So you have that level of security versus the unknown, no matter how highly you project a quarterback, the unknown of, say, a Baker. Like, if you're the Bengals right now coming into this season, like, what would the equivalent be? Not even like Russell Wilson for Burrow, or would it be Deshaun Watson? So it would be like Deshaun Watson for Burrow.
Yeah.
Right? That would be the debate right now. I don't know that that's a slam dunk, go take Deshaun Watson. Now, we might have 2 years where Watson's a top three quarterback coming up. It's like, oh, you idiots, why wouldn't you have taken that? But I don't think it's a slam dunk, Watson versus Burrow, with, you know, the money situation coming up. Great, great. Fascinating, though, that Seattle was trying to be that aggressive. I told you, I really think they bought into this whole, man, that's going to kill our salary cap. We can't build the rest of our team. You know, that's going to kill us. And this, they tried to get out of it.
Yeah, this would have been right around them needing to extend every member of that defense that still remained. Yep. You know, Sherman, Wagner, yeah. Earl Thomas, right, would have been still there at that point. And it would have been, yeah, and do we keep the Legion of Boom intact, or do we pay the quarterback?
And listen, this is what I'm saying about the NFL right now. I don't know. I don't know if people know how to interpret what happened in the past, right? I feel like so future decisions are made based off what you think happened in the past. In other words, I think Seattle could look at this last two seasons in two different ways, right? They could either say, we had to pay Russell Wilson, and look at us, a fringe playoff team. We can't get over the hump. The rest of our roster is really limiting us. We don't have a Richard Sherman at corner anymore. We don't have a legit free safety. We just don't have that team around our quarterback anymore. We're really hindered by this contract. Or they could look at their roster and say, we have a terrible roster right now compared to what we had. It's really in the bottom half of the league. It is, right? They don't have a great overall coverage unit. The receiving core is not very good. The O-line's not good. It's a bad roster overall compared to the rest of the league. However, we have Russell Wilson, and because of that, we're a playoff team, and we made it to the divisional round and all this stuff, right? Or whatever they made it to last year. Which way do you think they view it? Because depending on which lens you look through, your future decisions will be made through that. If you think Russell Wilson's the guy that's been carrying you the last couple of years, you feel good about, hey, we just got to do a little better job building around him. If you think Russell Wilson's contract is what's holding you down, you're going to continue to look to get out of it and say, I don't care if it's Josh Allen, we'll just make him okay because we need the rest of the pieces.
Yeah, I think it's fair.
All right. Your question on the last dance here. What would you want to see from an NFL standpoint?
Yeah. You have one?
Yeah, I think anything Belichick-Brady related. Because there's just no... But this, every NFL fan should want that. This is the obvious, right? There's no... Belichick gets up there, gives the same bland answers, and Brady gives the company line. Like, to be a fly on the wall for any point in their careers for what they were thinking, right? Because you and I, we have a little bit of access backstage, like to this guy who talks to this guy who talks to this guy who talks to Belichick, and you get like little snippets that like he's funny, he's snarky, he'll kind of make fun of people around the league a little bit and this and that, like things that he would never do. Like they're going up against the 0-16 Dolphins. They're like, oh, this is the best team we've played all year. I mean, it's the biggest game this week. But behind the scenes, he's like, what is this joke, right? Like, to be a fly on the wall for that type of stuff and get the real story for everything that they were thinking along the way, I think would be outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think Belichick and Brady definitely get, like, so obviously this is like a 20-year thing. Any particular aspect of it? Because the last couple of years of the divorce would seem to make a lot of sense.
I think so there would be the divorce. I think the 07 stuff. You know, because again, you don't know, like, there were leaks that came out during the 07 undefeated deal that guys were pressing, that like the Brewskis of the world and the Junior Seos of the world, like they kind of wanted it, and that it was almost like to be in the building and hear how they were talking about this and were they motivated by going undefeated, I thought would have been interesting. There was a point in the 2014 season when they turned it around and, you know, Brady looks like he's going to lose it. And then they go on the Super Bowl run. And then I think the end, you know, 2017, where there's these rumors in, you know, that they stop believing in Brady and he's in the middle of an MVP season. And then the following year, they win the Super Bowl with him at quarterback. I think those are a couple of the key points. I think that would be awesome. And then, of course, just the Bledsoe Brady decision that started it all back in 2001.
Yeah, those would be interesting. I've got two. So
yeah,
I think, again, sort of like any period with Brett Favre, there's no end of like absurd stuff, I'm sure, with Favre, whether it was earlier in his career dealing with addiction, whether it's the Minnesota Vikings year where he comes back and wrecks the Packers and almost takes the Vikings to this absurd Super Bowl out of the middle of nowhere. Like Brett Favre is still making headlines years after he retired for, you know, taking money and not doing speeches or whatever it was. So basically almost anything you do with Brett Favre, I think, would be pretty amazing. The other one, though, is one that I'm diving into at the moment for this podcast series that we've been teasing. This Montana versus Young dynamic, right? We sort of think of this now through the lens of the fact that both guys were surefire Hall of Famers and they followed one after the other, and there was a period where they overlapped and there was some tension. But almost neither guy was that way when it first started. Like, Montana was beloved and, you know, the 49ers were nothing before Montana and Walsh arrived, right? They'd never won a championship. And then he arrives, they win a couple. Now Joe is like unimpeachable. He's loved. They can't, like, they'll never, he, you know, there'll never be negativity for Montana in San Francisco because of what he did for the franchise. But it was two, right? He was still sort of, it was almost like the mid years of Brady, where they hadn't won for the few years. And it was like, well, maybe Brady isn't as clutch as we thought he was. And maybe this dynasty isn't as good as everybody thought it was. They haven't won in the postseason for a while. That was kind of what was happening in San Francisco. Montana and Walt, they hadn't won one for a while. Steve Young comes on board and it's like, well, you know, Steve Young's a better athlete. He's got a better arm. It's not as accurate, but like maybe it is time to move on from. And the other thing is Montana was just kept breaking down, right? Just kept getting injuries constantly.
Right.
Dude, like I texted you, he played one season, 180 pounds. Like the guy's 6'2 or whatever he is, 180. That's what
He was injury prone. And so, but here's why Belichick and Walsh too are so fascinating, because they're the two coaches where Belichick hasn't written this stuff down, but if he wrote a book on like his thoughts, you would be like, that's innovative. You just see, like, he's an innovator. Walsh was an innovator. He has stuff in his book from 30 years ago where it's like, oh, this makes sense. This is where the league's going right now, today, right? So you would have these two guys who are not only focused on winning at all costs right now, but also have the long-term vision as well. And I think that's like, hey, Montana's my guy. I've done some great things with him, but where's the future going to go? Who's the next guy? Is Steve Young better right now? Can I upgrade the quarterback position right now, even over the great Joe Montana? Like, there's only a few coaches in history that would probably make those decisions. Maybe Pete Carroll's one of them. He was ready to, you know, haul Russell Wilson off.
Well, there's a couple of strands to it, right? It wasn't even just like, let's look to the future and you know, a time beyond Joe Montana, because I think around the time they made the trade for Steve Young, there was a very real feeling, not just with Walsh, but around the place that, you know, Montana might be getting towards the end of this. Like, he's breaking down pretty regularly. He's just come off, like, he came off major back surgery. And this is like back surgery in the 80s. Like, I don't
know. Yeah, that's when it was a big deal.
Right. I'm not massively au fait of the surgical innovations of the last 30 years, but like, you think of what computer or TV you were rolling with in the 80s and then translate that to surgical equipment. It had to have been pretty significant, right? Like, now you can do it through keyholes with little robots and blah, blah. Back then it was like a dude with a hacksaw and some basic gardening tools, you know? So the guy had significant back surgery in the 80s. Like, we are talking about a legitimate fear that Joe Montana might just be done at this point. But then the other interesting thing is Steve Young was not Steve Young back then. Like, he had had one good year in college. He signed this monster deal at the USFL, played 4 years there, and played kind of badly for 4 years. Went to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, didn't play well there, but the entire Buccaneers organization was like a joke at that point. they rehire, or they hired a new coach. Ray Perkins comes in. His sort of job one is to evaluate the whole roster and sort of convey that to the owner and decide what he wants to do. He determined that they did not have a quarterback on the roster that could take them to a Super Bowl. This is Steve Young. He's basically saying Steve Young is not a Super Bowl quarterback. Get rid of this guy. Draft Vinny Testaverde. That's how we get there. So Steve Young was not Steve Young back then, right? He's this incredibly like eager to play guy, goes to San Francisco, and then just spends the next few years of his life like desperately trying to get this starting gig. And what was really so what's so interesting about it is Montana keeps opening the door by getting hurt, right, constantly and missing some time. Steve Young comes in. Bill Walsh, if anything, was like fostering this idea by not just saying, look, Montana's a starter and Young's going to have to deal with that. Like he kept opening the door and saying, well, we don't know who's going to start this week and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, Montana would think that, hey, Bill Young or Bill Walsh loved this idea of competition at every spot. Like your place is not guaranteed. You've got a guy breathing down your neck every single spot. You need to earn it every week, right? It's just that most people don't extend that to quarterbacks. Young or Bill Walsh, why do I keep calling him Young? Bill Walsh might have actually thought that having a viable threat to Joe Montana's job was a good thing. And then the other thing that made it so interesting is neither of those guys backed away from the idea there was a quarterback controversy, like in the media, right? Like Young is constantly talking about, yeah, I want the starting job. And yeah, I mean, if Joe Montana gets hurt, I'm not going to lie, a little piece of me is going, yeah, I get a chance to start. And Montana's spending the entire time saying, guy, I mean, this dude is breathing down my neck. Like, if that happened today, there would be this like defined media strategy of like, neither of you guys mention a freaking word about a quarterback controversy.
Like, well, millennials can't handle competition, Sam. You know what it is. It's a millennial thing. They're real sensitive. They turn TVs off and all that stuff, right? Got to blame millennials.
So I think like there's an easy 10-part thing in that. I mean, I think we're going to end up doing one for our podcast series and try and get it into like an hour. But it's such a fascinating thing to revisit, particularly with the lens that both those guys wound up being these Hall of Famers. Like you trade for Steve Young. It's a very real, well, maybe Montana's done. And then the dude, he's literally like half a game away from losing his job because of the way things have focused, gets back in and then wins two more Super Bowls. And it's like, sorry, Steve, sit your ass back down on the bench for a while.
Well, then it's like, how much was I hate using system, like how much was just Walsh and the new system and passing when teams thought you were running, changing the league in the 80s with a pass first West Coast system, fitting them in, having the best receiver of all time and Jerry Rice, plus some other good playmakers around that, stealing, you know, passes to the backs and all those different things. So all those things added up too, to put them in this environment where they could also get success out of Joe Montana, transition to Steve Young. So many things there. I don't know if our listeners saw the guy that stitched together week two of 1988 and turned it into the Red Zone channel yesterday. It was outstanding. I do suggest you go. It's 4+ hours. He took 6 games from week two of 1988 and he cut the game at the right time each time, like you were watching the Red Zone channel, put commentary over the top, updated it. And in the middle of that, it's week two, 1988. And Steve Young got the start over Joe Montana. And then Joe Montana comes back into the game. He's healthy and leads the comeback. So it was, first off, the effort. I think it was Jaguar Gator 9. I don't know. So if you want to watch it, search 1988 Red Zone channel.
This is more of like the stuff I'm talking about, right? Where it's the kind of stuff Bill Walsh was doing to foster this is like Montana's healthy, but not healthy enough to start, only healthy enough to back up. It's like, what are you doing?
That doesn't make sense. But, you know, to your point, Sam, you were like, oh, you know, bring in a bunch of quarterbacks in would never work. There's too many egos to play. Like, this did work, and football is such an emotional game where the football coach takes very seriously his role in motivating.
Yeah.
Right? Again, it's a Belichick thing. Walsh, all the best coaches are great at motivating. And I think they found something. Walsh definitely found something, which is like, hey, the quarterback is probably the most difficult position to motivate if the guy isn't self-motivated. And this, right, because it's like you're the one guy, you're the starter, you're not competing. Every other job has competition. This was his way of doing it and getting the most out of him, and maybe it worked.
I tell you,
obviously
thing,
it worked.
One thing that I've never really thought about before, but it just occurred to me while you were talking about how much the West Coast offense and the system changed everything. Like, Montana's reputation is built on comebacks, right? It's built on being Joe Cool, and when the chips were down, that's when he showed up and brought everything back. Now, undermining the point I'm just about to make, he also did this in college, so it's not like it's just the system. But the West Coast offense might have been uniquely suited to executing comebacks, right? Like, one of the criticism of the run and shoot was always, once you got a lead in the fourth quarter, you couldn't run the ball out and chew clock, right? You'd go three and out one time and you'd give them a possession, and suddenly your lead has disappeared. The West Coast offense, you're in a position where once you need to come back, you actually need this sort of quick passing, take 8 yards every time and just move the ball down the field. Like, that's what the West Coast offense is. If you have a more vertical passing offense or run heavy, like, those are less well suited to pull up, you know, to take 8 yards every 15 seconds and just keep chunking down the field. So I wonder how much of Montana's sort of legacy of the comeback kid and all these kind of things were built on the idea that he was running an offense that made that easier than other offenses.
And that's where I think him and Brady are similar too, because the best quarterbacks just make the right decisions, and they actually know when to be a little bit more conservative and they know when to be more aggressive. And Brady's been great at comebacks too, in part because, yeah, the best quarterbacks are always generally good at those, but there's also knowing when to take shots, knowing when to be aggressive, knowing when to take the 8 yards. And I think Montana and Brady are as patient as any quarterbacks in history at taking what's there. You read coverage, you read it out, you know the time, and then you take the shots when needed. So it does kind of fit with what Montana did back then. So that's great. Do you want to hear the food poisoning story from 2007?
Oh yeah, go on. What have you got?
Okay. So in minor league baseball, we aren't fed a whole lot of food. So especially at the low levels, the Nashua Pride Canadian American Independent League, we would only get fed post game essentially. So you get like a tub of peanut butter and some bread before the game. That's your pregame meal. And you just go make your peanut butter sandwich. You have like 144 peanut butter sandwiches in 150 days, peanut butter and jelly or whatever you like to have on it. And then post game, they give you like a hot meal or whatever. So our front office, they would get fed pregame. So whatever we would have after the game, from which we always get it from like a different restaurant or something, they would have it pregame. So being minor league baseball players, we complained a lot. We're like, you guys don't feed us, blah, 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 blah. So we used to always complain about not getting fed pregame. So it's one particular day, the post-game meal is going to be like a Thanksgiving dinner, turkey, gravy, the works. The front office had it before the season, before the game, and it was like kind of sitting outside in the sun. I don't know for how long, but it's just sitting out there. And I may be at fault here. I may have made the request that our guys in the locker room would love to have some of this pre-game meal, because it looks like you have a ton of leftovers. So the guy in charge, our clubhouse manager, says, sure, bring it in. So I walk into the clubhouse with this huge tub of turkey and gravy and mashed potatoes or whatever was on it. And it was like, yeah, I know you don't watch Seinfeld, but turns into like the Seinfeld episode where Frank is having flashbacks to the World War II when he poisoned all of the troops. And, you know, he's having flashbacks about this. He walks in with a tub of food and he sees everybody getting poisoned. That was me. I poisoned our entire team. So I come in with this pregame meal, which, by the way, I had already, like, I went out and bought my own sandwich that day, so I didn't need to eat it. So I brought all the food into the clubhouse for guys to eat. I look like a hero because I'm feeding my teammates before the game. And probably four or five guys ate it, you know, because everybody else had their normal routine. Four or five guys ate it. So within 5 days, for however long this took, we had the entire front office that ate this stuff in and out of the hospital with food poisoning. We had multiple guys on our team, our pitching coach, our starting third baseman. And then the funniest guy who got it was a guy named El Guapo, Rich Garces. And you got to, Sam, Google him right now, Rich Garces. He's about 6 feet tall, 300 pounds. He became an absolute legend in Boston because he was an awesome relief pitcher. And at this point, he was just end of his career. He was our closer, and he was kind of just like a novelty act at this point in his career, but still like really good. El Guapo got food poisoning. So probably 2 days later, we're we have a road game, and, you know, as relief pitchers, a lot of times you go back into the clubhouse to kind of like prepare for the later innings. So we all had this routine, me and the other relievers, we'd go in the fourth inning, we go into the clubhouse, you kind of like sauce up your arm and, you know, get ready, right? So Guapo starts to, he goes to the clubhouse an inning early. The clubhouse on this road, in this field on the road, our bullpen is way down the right field line. The clubhouse, you have to go all the way to left field and through the wall to get into the clubhouse. So it's like the second inning. He's actually multiple innings early. The second inning. And I look up and Guapo, 300 plus pounds, is running as fast as he can from the right field bullpen across the field to left field. And me and my buddy were like, what's Guapo doing? He's going way too early. And to get out of the stadium, you need somebody to like open the door from the outside. So this is like in between innings, 300 pound man sprinting across the field. And he gets to left field and he's like banging on the wall for somebody to let him out. Right. So he finally gets let out and he goes into the clubhouse. Me and my buddy, we go like the next inning to go do our post game prep. And we walk into the clubhouse, which is pretty small. It's like a little trailer. And it was the worst smell we've ever smelled in our entire life. And we're like, Guapo, what's going on? And he's like, oh, estomago no bueno, man. No, that was, I mean, stomach is no good. That's what it means in Spanish. So poor Guapo's got food poisoning as well. Absolutely destroying our entire clubhouse. Our general manager, I think, was in and out of the hospital 5 or 6 times with this food. Now, I didn't feed him, but it just showed what the food poisoning issue was. It was bad. So everybody in the front office has it. 4 or 5 players have it. Our pitching coach, all of the players that got sick. It was all my fault, and it was bad. And El Guapo was the funniest guy that got it because it was just it was a mess. You got to watch him sprint across the field at 300 pounds.
You didn't
and
even
all
eat
that
this.
Said. What's that?
You didn't even eat this.
I didn't eat it. No. So because it was at the point in the season where I was so sick of the peanut butter sandwiches that I would go to like a local sub shop. So it's like between batting practice and the start of the game, you have like 3 hours to kill. So I'd go to like a local sub shop or whatever and get my sub. So I'd already gotten my sandwich for the day and I ate it. But I was trying to be a good teammate because everybody always complained about not having good food before I was like, look, I got turkey dinner for you guys. And if I remember the locker room, it was our hitting coach, pitching coach, third baseman, a few other guys had it, and then Guapo was so excited. I mean, he sprinted twice in this story. He sprinted across the locker room to go get the food that day. He had a huge plate of it, and it came back to bite. But much like the late 90s Bulls, we rallied and won the league championship that year, despite being poisoned by food about 2/3 of the way through the season. It was a big deal. Like, we had to fill out paperwork for a lawsuit and all sorts of stuff.
Not so much poisoned by food as poisoned by you.
Yeah, it might be my fault.
Yeah.
I think it's a good story. I thought it was fun.
Well, you would have been sort of just, you know, it would have made sense if you would also been a victim of this, right? It's like, yeah, look, I tried to do a nice thing and we all got sick. But no, you inflicted it upon everybody.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I feel bad about it. I feel bad.
Yeah.
Made for some funny commentary, though. I mean, I was getting a little nostalgic this weekend, tweeting out some baseball videos. I tweeted one good one of me with a behind-the-back snag on a ground ball. And then I did make fun of myself. I tweeted a video of me getting hit in the leg with a line drive and then giving up an absolute bomb for a walk-off homer. So we had some fun this week. The people liked that one a lot more than anything else. Me giving up the walk-off homer.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty funny.
Did you like that tweet? Were you one of the many likes on that?
I saw it.
Oh, you should go check it out.
I'm confused as to how this guy who's the guy you made me Google appears under a thing saying the fattest man in baseball history. This dude was, you know, good and in the majors, and yet you, not so much.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, when I was playing with him, so he's 49 right now. That was he was 37 and he was a novelty act, just kind of like ending his career. Like, he was in the big leagues at like 21. He was legit. But when we were in Nashua, there's a lot of Nashua pictures. Check out the Google picture of him. And instead of a bobblehead night, we had a bobble belly night. We had him with a bobble belly. He's holding it. Yeah, there he is. Guapo Bobble Belly Night. It was great. He's a legend. Boston legend. He was the closer. I was the eighth inning guy. Teammates. All right. That'll do it for today. Enough baseball talk, but the people have been asking for it. So we'll be back Thursday. We'll answer some questions. We're not doing questions today, right?
No.
Do questions on Thursday? Sure. Thursday, we'll do some questions. Let us know. Pass the salmonella, Ronan. Let us know what else you guys want to hear about. And yeah, we'll just talk some more NFL football and maybe some more baseball stories if the people want them. Maybe I'll let you have one rugby story on Thursday, Sam.
Sweet.
All right. Everybody, enjoy. We'll see you guys Thursday.
Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.
Napa Know How.
Get all the quality parts you need at your locally owned Napa. Because right now, when you order from Napa online, you can pick up curbside at your local store in just 30 minutes. Or get your order delivered direct to your door with free one-day shipping and over 160,000 quality parts when you spend $35 or more. Quality parts delivered quickly and safely. That's Napa Know-How.
Napa Know-How.
At participating stores, standard ground shipping and exclusions apply.